Hello, and welcome to this week's podcast. I am your host, Nish Kumar. No, I'm not Nish. I was just talking about Nish on the bonus material, the extraneous bits, the offcuts on the Patreon video stream. I say how much I love Nish, but how in the mind of the right-wing media or right-wing media pundits, he epitomizes multiculturalism, socialism, any kind of move away from their staid, purist, traditional, in quotation marks, view of the world. And how Nish has said, like, underlying all of that really is them thinking of him as a mouthy P word, a racial terminology, disgusting racial terminology that I'm not going to commit to a podcast. Think of him as, like, you know, like uppity P word. But Nish is great. But I was saying, it's just the further you go in the comedy career, we know. Oh, it's snowing. Fuck. This fucking nutty weather. This nutty fucking weather. It's snowing. This is the day before the day you were listening to this, or it might be many days before. It might be. I mean, I'm assuming you're listening to it straight away, because if you're not, you're ripping out your mother's heart. But you might be listening to this way in the future. But yeah, how you get to a certain point in comedy, probably in any of the arts really, but in comedy, when you get to TV and radio, when you migrate across to there, the opportunities for people who aren't of sons and daughters of privilege diminish. I'll just read the quotes. So it's from, it's in this, it's about, so it's in the New York Review of Books, and it's about Stuart Lee and his brilliant King Rocker. And Stuart will be the first to tell you that he wasn't a son or daughter of privilege, but he did go to Cambridge, I think, or Oxford, one of those. He went to one of those schools. But maybe, I think then there was, even if it was just like the top 4% who were going to university, or maybe just going to them types of university, there might have been schemes. And I think he said he got funding to go there. So he might get a bursary or something. But it said Lloyd's career, that's Robert Lloyd, the subject of King Rocker from the Night, Robert Lloyd from the Nightingale. Lloyd's career, like those of many post-war British artists and writers and musicians, would likely not have been possible without the support of social welfare. The austerity ideology that has taken hold of British politics since the Thatcher years has ensured that capital C culture is produced almost exclusively by the sons and daughters of privilege, for the simple reason that no one else can afford the time and freedom necessary for a creative life, because you're having to do jobs, other jobs, to supplement your income. That socioeconomic reality, formed around a neoliberal ideology, is a wellspring of the culture of mediocrity that Lee invokes in the film's opening moments. And the example he uses is Comedy Central's Roast Battle, but I've got a lot of friends who have done that show. I've not actually watched it. I've not watched it, but it looks good. I think it looks like, you know, solid entertainment. Not everything has to have, huge artistic integrity, or even any, like, you know, it could just be built around a very simple concept of people mugging each other off, and the electricity of the moment is just in people mugging each other off. I was thinking while I said that, so I forgot what I didn't know. I was still talking, but what Stuart Lee says on Owen Jones' podcast was something that's rare. On television, that he tried to put into King Rocker was just a group of people laughing at each other generously, and building upon a like a you know a pre-existing idea, or just, you know, just like I said it, I think I said it on the last week's one about Davy Jones, and when he was like after I performed at Glee, yeah, he made it was like a premise where he was advertising a roller disco, and then we'd all be part of the advert and chip in, and it was just there was no one-upmanship. People weren't trying to out-funny each other, which is what roast battle is by its very nature, and some people love that. I personally don't. I don't like the roast battle format. I've taken part in a few. There's only one I enjoyed myself. It's not. I'm not that great at it. But me and Davina did one. It was quite fun because there's the love and intimacy there. So we knew we could kind of rip into each other and it wouldn't. You know, it wouldn't. Things would just resume as we left off after the show. It's quite fun to get really personal with your mates. But on this Sunday brunch that I was talking about, the programme with the bloke from Soccer AM and the chef, you had three guests. You had three guests, and all of them were, you had Rick Edwards, you had Catherine, I think, is it Catherine Perkinson, the actor from IT Crowd? Catherine, what's her name? What's her little name? What's her little name? How patronised. What's her little tiny name? Catherine Parkinson. So you had Rick Edwards, Catherine Parkinson, and Nish. And that's Cambridge, Oxford, and Durham. Those three universities in that order, I think. I know Nish is Durham. It just like out of everyone. And then I've started watching shows like that. Looking at the backgrounds of the different people who are taking part, and it's still very much I'm still very much out of favor, or I'll be, if I am put on saying, I'll be treated as like a novelty, like Scumbag Essex Week, working class commissions. We're doing our 4-year working class commissions, and then I'll bring them thanks. I have to try and take advantage of that little window. But going back to the story, so neoliberalism's war on higher education. I've got this book here. I don't know if this would be American or I think it'll be more skewed towards America. It's got like Chicago Teachers Union. But there might be some stuff that we find applicable. Neoliberals learn dystopian education in a neoliberal society. Ah, okay. British divide. American-British divide. 65. There we go. Okay, let's get to the students against widening the lens. It's got some Occupy. Okay. So higher education and the erasure of critical formative cultures. So in a social order dominated by relentless privatization, yes, we know that, and commodification of everyday life and the elimination of critical public spheres, yes. You could say Twitter is a critical public sphere, but it's just like, I don't like to commit to hyperbole or and stuff, but it's a fucking cesspit, isn't it? It's just people. I think critical disputation needs to be temperate, or there needs to be a form of homeostasis and balance in which people can state their views while maintaining such temperance, if I'm using that correctly, I think I am. Whereas Twitter forces people to be utterly trenchant in their beliefs. Utterly trenchant. And and they always take the most. You're almost forced into in extremis with your viewpoints, because that's the tempo of a Twitter exchange. It always escalates that, doesn't it? And so this says, young people find themselves in a society in which the formative cultures necessary for a democracy to exist have been more or less eliminated or reduced to spectacles of consumerism, made palatable through a diet of talk shows, reality TV, and celebrity culture, which I think is a bit reductive. There is a good bit in, I'm just getting a book. This is all part of it. It's all part of it, mate. It's all part of it. The book Sea State by Tabitha Lasley. Now, this is about offshoremen. And there's, these are kind of like these northern working class boys done good with this entrepreneurial instinct and this drive and an understanding that the money they accumulate and the lifestyle they build could go away at any moment. So they have this really solid work ethic, which is not just the preserve of working class people, but it's a trait I identify in a lot of working class people. They can't rest on their laurels. It's like with me, like I've got this book deal, I could have like leant back and gone, no, let the book deal do it, let the book when it comes out do its work. But no, I'm still grabbing every other opportunity I can get, because I realize the momentum of that will diminish very, 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 very quickly, and then it'll be on to the next thing, and I have to keep pumping stuff out and enhancing my visibility to get above the parapet. And I haven't been great during lockdown because I've been writing a book, and B, because I know what my mode or medium will be most flattering to me, will help me gain visibility in the right way. And it ain't through, actually, it could be through Twitch. I love banging on. But I don't know, does this sort of stuff, aren't you supposed to always be doing games and, like, isn't there supposed to be lots of, like, high concept stuff on Twitch? Like, it seems to be people who've got, really good production value on their Twitch streams. They're the ones who stand out. So if it's just me talking to a camera, no people ain't going to go for that, are they, at all? I mean, I could do it, I suppose, with a little like twirling, like dancing baby animation, but just sort of a twirling turd just spinning beside me. And people are like, that's odd. There's something jarring about that. I'll click on that, see what it is. And then it's me talking about the neoliberalism's war on higher education. Or I could CGI a butthole over my face. So I'm a huffing, talking, butt, or belly button. I'm a belly button. Hello, sir. And then people are like, whoa, that man's got a belly button face. Let's click on that. I need to know what's behind that. I need to know what's behind that. What's the story there? Nah, I don't know. Maybe not. And then, or the people who have got a good, a background in sketch and improv, they find it very easy to then create an online following that's just, to camera, little vignettes and stuff like that are amazing and incredible. That's not my background, buddy boy. I kind of don't want to channel my time and energy into that when I can already feel it being miserable. Constantly looking at the arbitrary metrics of, it's the reason why I love doing this podcast, because it's now got like a steady base of loyalists who come in and listen. So every single week, there's always going to be 92 people who come and listen to every week. And then And then each episode start, then new people start discovering it and they start building and building and building. And then the last two episodes have both got, one got 148 and one has got, is nearly on 200. So do you know what? That's why I like, makes it all worthwhile. But I'm the sort of person that if I've put in a gig and only three people have turned up, doesn't matter. I think those three people have made it. They're looking for a show. Dispel or diffuse any awkwardness. And then just get on with the show and make them part of it. Make it inclusive. Don't perform at them because then it's weird. But perform with them. And you know, I've actually had some amazing shows that have been like three people. So if there's like my Patreon, I haven't got hundreds and hundreds of people waiting for my Patreon content, but I've got enough for me to think that these people, you lot in there, you're liking this, you're liking me. It's all worthwhile. But I feel that there's more of a pressure if you've got a Twitch stream and stuff. I don't know. But yeah, in that book, so Caden, talk about Caden. He's just like this boy done good, hyper consumerist, muscles and suntan and tattoos kind of guy. And she said, this is actually not the bit I wanted to read out, but I'll read this bit anyway, so I like it. Pardon. The more I saw of him, the more I noticed his malleability. He was like water. He assumed the form of whomever he was with at the time. After a few days with me, he'd parrot my opinions. After a few days at home, he'd come back full of new ideas, presumably cribbed from his friends. I was starting to realise that much of what I'd thought of as his personality was just stuff I'd dreamt up during his long absences. Yes. When people say, oh, you're in love with the idea of that person. They start to, the more distance you have from someone, the more mentally their cipher that's in your head starts to magpie other bits of people's personalities and idiosyncrasies and traits that you know. Build a weird mishmash of different bits and bobs in your head. It's a constructed personality. Like I know my ex-girlfriend, miss her deeply, still, you know, still feel a certain amount of love for her. But, you know, we definitively drew a line underneath it and just terminated contact. But I know if I saw her now, like obviously you'd have affection that would come back. That you had to have residual affection, but I probably think, oh, this isn't who left me. Like, this isn't quite who I thought was there. And I'm sure she'd feel the same thing. But it's that's why it's always good to try and, if you are looking to renew an aborted romance or something, to where if you meet up with them again, like to just go, I'm not doing that by the way, but if you meet up with them, just try and take the rose-tinted glasses off. I mean, the first thing she'd say is like, fuck me, you has got fat, boy. Actually, when she left me, I was fat. And I thought that was the reason, but she wasn't superficial in the slightest. I don't think he was. I won't say it. it's not for me to tell. This guy, and I dreamt of it in the same way. I used to fill in the blank oval with his face with features like his but not his. I'd created a character that alluded to him while being subtly different. His real character was harder to pin down. He had no principles or politics to speak of. There was nothing he'd die in a ditch for, no side worth taking up, taking but his own. Unusually for an only child, he didn't just dislike his own company, but seemed to fear it and was thrown into panic by the prospect of spending time alone, which is exactly like my best friend, Louis Simons. He's like that. He cannot be in his own company. He always has to have a bloody audience, that boy. Guess on my tits. No, I'm joking. I love him. I haven't seen him for a while. I can say that kind of stuff to him. And yeah, the other thing, so the other thing she said about this guy, and I know these guys, I know exactly who she's talking about, and they are, that you know, they're shoppers. They go round, they on their time off, when they're on leave, away, their whole life is just kind of this really basic life of graft and then spend. Graft and spend, that's all they do, and their ways of showing love and showing affection is to spend, is to buy their wives or their girlfriends just things, just constant fucking things. And I'm like that, books, you know, I like to buy a lot of books, but it's about the acquisition of knowledge within the books and what I'm reading about and the information. It's not, and also, you know, there's some books that come in a post that are beautifully designed. But yeah, they just graft. And if they're not grafting and buying, they're watching Grand Designs. Which I actually read, let me get that, an interesting article about. My mum and dad love that shit. They love, all they ever watch is home renovation. And HGTV, who are the American company that that make all these shows, HGTV, like the Property Brothers, that's their biggest franchise, or like their biggest on-air talent is the Property Brothers. But they make it, I mean, they're trying to move on to something else, but they make it with the idea of it being tranquilizing television. So like Lindsay Widehorn, a former HGTV executive who oversaw Fixer Upper, and who currently runs her own production company, approvingly told Country Living that the network was like Xanax. You know, these property things, there's no... And I realised, well, during lockdown, I've only been able... The only thing I've been able to swallow when it comes to... I've been reading incessantly, but the only thing I've been able to swallow in as TV or film is I'll sometimes watch bits of The Circle with my mum and dad. Line of Duty started, so I'm watching that with them every week. But then also I've watched Modern Family, all 10, is it 10 or 11? 10 series all the way through 4 times. And the reason is I mean, it's just a really well-written comedy show. A brilliant ensemble, just an amazing cast. Not really any weak links in it, although Manny becomes quite creepy. He's like, as a kid, he's quite cute and quite sharp, and you know, an old soul, old beyond his years. But as a grown up, he's like a bit of a those like male feminists that are harassing girls. That's what Manny becomes. But the other reason I could tolerate it is the three primary couplings, marriages, are never under threat, ever. There's never any like outside person who's like trying to interfere in a marriage, and you know, but actually has has potential to like ruin their marriage. Like then you know they'll never get divorced. You'll know they'll never ever separate. It's never. They've never even, you know, tried a storyline where, like, for a couple of episodes is on the rocks. It's just, they're always set in stone, which so there's a permanence to it, a comforting, cozy permanence. Kind of like a, you know, you get fluffy handcuffs. It's like that, but a whole prison cell. That's what marriage is. Big fluffy prison cell. And what is particularly troubling, this is back to war on higher education, what is particularly troubling in US society is the absence of the vital formative cultures necessary to construct questioning persons who are capable of seeing through the consumer come-ons, who can dissent and act collectively and increasingly imperil democracy. This is why I've got beef with the Alzheimer's Society, right? A lot of you raising money for the Alzheimer's Society, brilliant, fine. That's your prerogative, and they do a hell of a lot of good things as well. But also, they always promote this kind of one-size-fits-all homogenous approach to speaking with people to people with dementia, which is massively fucking offensive. Like, it's person-centered care. It's individualized, personalized, personally tailored care. That's the whole point. Well, I'll get onto this because I'm half getting into it. In the old book, and the fucking Alzheimer's Society they'll issue like memorandums saying like, here's a list of how you should speak to them, and here's a list of things you shouldn't say to them. And you can't tell me that you can't have a prescribed way on how to talk to people with dementia, because in the same way that we afford ourselves complexities and say we're multifaceted human beings, then so are people with dementia, mate. Right. Well, I mean, the concept of personhood is, so you imagine it, it's like the philosopher and psychologist William James drew a line between the empirical ego, which in his words, or in the words of actually really Rick H. Hoyle in Self and Identity, Esteem and Regulation, is synthesis of sensory experience, perhaps encoded in memory, yet influenced by new experiences. And then the pure ego, which is the core of human existence, aka the soul. I imagine my soul as Diogenes of Sinope residing in the pithos or tub. But my body, currently bloated, once lithe, is the tub. And you can also substitute Diogenes of Sinope for Morph. That's me and my soul. Morph in a tub, in a yogurt pot. Morph in a yogurt pot is my soul. And so, yeah, and then James, in Principles of Psychology, describes the individual social self as the recognition he gets from his mates. Was that like, so he, his pals, his buddies, in particular, whether your friends are sick of your shit or not, that's basically what that is, I think. And Hoyle goes on to say that, in essence, James argued that the individual has as many social selves as he or she has meaningful acquaintances. So this array of front-facing selves adapted to suit the company you keep in any given social situation is just one part of what it is to be a human. And Sam Popowich, in an essay titled The Problem of Neutrality and Intellectual Freedom, he said, when a person reaches the age of discretion, they then, as self-determining adults, decide for themselves what they think about things, what they consider important, and what their values are. We'll go into that. So intellectual freedom is the defense of this individual self-determination, the result of a taken for granted individual agency, also known as liberty. So they decide for themselves what they think about things. I think about a lot of things. What do I think about things? I think too much to think about. There's too many things I think about to think about this. What they consider important. Care ethics seems to be the maypole around which my life congregates. I think care ethics and everything that branches off from care ethics. But then some people have said, you know, care ethics isn't necessarily a thing in itself, it's an extension of like, what's the other ones they use? I'll just get the
Just getting my book. I've got about a million books on this shit.
Oh, my bum just. My butt, I've got to that point. Someone actually shouted out the door the other day, fat cunt. So I'm there now. It's a nice milestone for me. I'm there. In the eyes of the world, I am officially a fad boy once again. Back once again with the Renegade Master. D4 down, I'm a fat E8. I'm a fat E-fat. I'm a fat E-fat. So care ethics, according to... I've got fucking loads of these, man. So many of these books. So caring democracy. A political argument for the ethic of care. And the argument will not seem at home in the context of much recent democratic political theory. Many political theorists have dedicated their recent work to demonstrate how undemocratic and brutal modern liberal democracies have become, and how often liberal democratic regimes end up reducing some people to mere life. So we definitely want to break away from. So I really believe that people shouldn't be reduced to a kind of neuronal Mexican wave. They shouldn't be considered just their biological functions. And this is why I also, and you're going to get annoyed by this stuff. This is why also, you've heard me state in here a few times that I am a materialist, an etherealist, not a materialist. I'll just expound on that. That's what I mean. Marilyn Robinson wrote a brilliant article called Humanism. And it was about, so I'll read from that. She will be able to, her problems with science, neuroscience. So while inquiries into the substance of reality reveal further subtleties in, you know, metaphysics and stuff like that, like the example she used for that, so neuroscience asserts a model of mental function as straightforward, causally speaking, as a game of billiards, and plumes itself on just this fact. It is by no means entangled with the sciences that addressed ontology. The most striking and consequential changes in the second of these, ontology, brings about no change at all in the first, which is neuroscience, either simultaneous or delayed. The gist of neuroscience is that the adverbs simply and merely can exercise the mystifications that have always surrounded the operations of the mind / brain, exposing the machinery that in fact produces emotion, behavior, and all the rest. That's what I mean by a neuronal Mexican wave. So while inquiry into the substance of reality reveals for quarks and shit, it further subtleties, idioms of relation that are utterly new to our understanding, neuroscience tells us that the most complex object we know of, the human brain, can be explained sufficiently in terms of the activation of packets of neurons, which evolution has provided the organism in service of homeostasis, which is balance or, you know, equilibrium. And that's why they say, like, where I say to people, if you're feeling depressed at this moment in time, I know it's no consolation when you're actually in it, but it will pass. You will get through this organically, because your brain is always striving to revert back to a homeostatic state. And it will do that by, you know, if you're really depressed, you'll try and pump out more dopamine. I mean, you might not feel happy, but you will feel neutral again. Aim for neutral. The amazing complexity of the individual cell is being pored over in other regions of science, when neuroscience persists in declaring the brain this same complexity, vastly compounded, an essentially simple thing. It's fucking nothing. It's brick-brack. Brick and Brack. It's all it is so things like them knackers. You hit one, it bops the other. Or knackers. Same things happen, except I think they're separated by... I don't think my two balls have ever hit together. I don't think they can. I think there's like a layer there where they... You'd feel it if they hit together. Even if anyone ever flick your ball, whew, mama, that hurts. I once did it to a girl who had as a joke, like she was in on it. Like someone I slept with, and she had one loose lip that you could roll up like a sleeping bag. And I flicked it to say, oh, does that hurt compared to... She flicked me in my bollock. I said, does that hurt compared to that? But apparently it didn't hurt as much. Don't think there's a concentration of nerves or whatever in a vagina. No, there is, isn't there? That's what they say. They say the G spot is a myth. It doesn't actually exist in this study of orgasm, female orgasm. It does. Oh, I can't remember what they said now. Yeah, apparently it doesn't exist. There's no specific place that you hit that. It's different for all different. It depends where there's like a higher concentration of nerves in that bit of the vagina, and this can be different in all different people, I think. And intravaginal orgasm is rarer than... This is why foreplay is so important for women, especially because it's the stuff on the outside. It's the stuff around it rather than up in it. Can Vita's go get that bit of sex chat slipping this morning? Oh, literally slipping. So, not literally, metaphorically. So, this effective simplicity, for which the living world seems to provide no analogy, this indeed would be one of nature's wonders, which we know, and we know that isn't true, don't we? We know that's rubbish. Because nothing is that simple. And it's the... And anthropocentricity that is a problem here, but the fact that it is unacknowledged and misapplied and all the while imputed to the other side of the controversy as if it were eo ipso a flagrant ever. The objectivity claimed by neuroscience implies that it is free of this bias, that there could be no more naive anthropocentricity than is reflected in the certainty and insistence that what we know about the nature of things at this moment makes us capable of definitive judgments about much of anything. That we have come to this place is not a failure of science, but a glorious achievement. The continuous opening of insights science itself could never have anticipated. Nothing can account for the reductionist tendencies among neuroscientists, scum, except a lack of rigor and consistency, a loyalty to conclusions that are prior to evidence and argument and indifferent to science as a whole. And this is a kind of criticism that is conventionally made against religion, whereas religion makes a lot of room for the complexities and mystifications. And we believe that underneath the root of everything will never be discovered. And in place of the stuff that we just, our brains are not equipped to conceptualize, is where religion floods in. But it seems mythic foolery, which I hate. I hate people are snobbish about religion. I get a hell of a lot out of it, man. Get a hell of a lot out of it. Every day is holy. That's what Quakers believe. And everyone is... There's an innate godliness within all of us, and you feel it. You feel sense of connection and stuff that go beyond. If just reducing it to physical
reducing it to the physical sensation. And they think he's clear-eyed and tough-minded and therefore rational and true. And that is the kind of people who are now COVID deniers. Same people who think that they're being economic rationalists, clear-eyed and the only sensible people in the room. They sustain such a lofty estimation of themselves. The evidence they offer is secondary to this conclusion and inadequate to it because it is based in a simplistic materialism that is now a nostalgia. The profound complexity of the brain is an established fact. The depiction of a certain traffic of activation in it can only understate its complexity. One might reasonably suspect that the large and costly machines that do the imaging are very crude tools whose main virtue is that they provide the kind of data their users desire and no more. So, yeah, that's why they annoy me. And the reason, I was going to get on to, the Alzheimer's Society. New Yorker. So they have this very one-size-fits-all approach. So in the Comforting Fictions of Dementia, read the Comforting Fictions of Dementia Care in the New Yorker. One of the best articles I've ever read on this subject. And yeah, I'm just trying to find... the bit where it's the Alzheimer's Society representative on the on this brilliant article, The Comforting Fiction of Dementia Care. So the British Alzheimer's Society. So some dementia experts felt that Garner's method. It was almost like an improv. So Garner's method has much in common with improv comedy, following the same rules. Never say no to the reality you're given. And so you stay consistent with their version of reality in order to keep people safely. So Garner's method, I'll read out this whole bit. I'm just taking photos for. So yeah, I'm just going to read out this whole bit. So in order to keep people, a person safely inside their world, it was necessary to figure out the boundaries and contents of that world. So the world that they're currently inhabiting, who lived in it, what activities took place there, and in what era, so that there would be as little dissonance as possible when the person used information from that past world to interpret the present. And we're all seeing, we're all experiencing the world as refracted through the prism of our own, mind. And who's to say that who's to say there's constant shifts and tweaks to how we all view reality to suit who's to say that their view of reality is empirical, is concrete anyway. And if there was someone missing from the present, for instance, because that person had moved away or died, it was necessary to arrive at an explanation for this absence that the person with dementia could accept. So you were constantly trying to work out the coordinates of their reality, and sometimes there would be two concurrent realities that'd be running simultaneously. So the husband is both alive and dead. And you roll with that. You roll with that. That's the thing. This is, imagine how much it would fuck you up if you were, you know, you're like, I'm sitting here recording a podcast in my bedroom, and then someone just comes into the room and goes, like, we've got to go to dinner with all your friends. I'm like, I ain't got any friends. What are you talking about? I'm here now. They're like, no, you've got to go sit with your friends. It's jelly night. And I'm like, I don't even like jelly. It's disgusting. It's just lime scale. Just fruity lime scale. Hard water. And they're like, no, you've got to go now. You'd be like, oh, I'm going to get angry now because this is madness. I'm in my room doing the podcast. They're like, podcasts haven't been a thing in 58 years. And that'd be really disorientating. So this had to be done in a careful process of trial and error. If, for example, the person asked often where the sun was, it was necessary to find out by experimenting with answers and watching their reactions, how old they believed their son to be at that moment, if they believed him to be a small child, and telling them truthfully that he was out of town or a medical conference, say. This would cause bewilderment or suspicion. But if they believed this to be a college student, telling them that he was playing in the garden would also be a mistake. Continuity was essential. Even a momentary glimpse of another reality, which is a beautiful way of thinking of it, of another reality that led patients to doubt their understanding of things would be horribly traumatic. All the more so because they would not remember exactly what they'd been traumatized by. And so would be left only with a feeling that something was threatening and incomprehensible. Garner's method had much to do in common with improv comedy. And Garner is actually... who is Garner? Garner, come to me, baby. Garner. Oh, come on, Garner. Where's reveal yourself? Penny Garner. So her name was Penny Garner, and in the late 1990s, she came with an approach to dementia care that was more radical in its rejection of truth-telling and aroused considerably more hostility. Christ, no, this is like the standard now. This woman's amazing. Amazing foresight. And through her mum, like she saw what happened to her mum. And you can tell this was like a ground floor, frontline, holistic approach. That this was actually people who deal with dementia up close and personal, not fucking GPs, not bureaucrats in top office. Garner's method had much in common with improv comedy following the same rules. Never say no to their... to the reality you're given. Say yes, and building on whatever the other person said. Don't ask questions. It also called in the same skills, quick thinking, refusal to be embarrassed, delight in the absurd, the best preparation for caring for people with dementia. You can see how G'd up I'm getting, because this was the first time I'd had something I felt very deeply validated in this article. So I was like punching the air when I read it. The best preparation for caring for people with dementia, Garner thought, was learning such techniques at drama school. And indeed, I'm not a buffoon. I'm not one of those drama nerds. I was too busy fucking. I'm too busy flinging my pork about. No, I was not. I was actually getting groomed. Not really, but ish. Not groomed. I was of age, Jess. I was barely legal. And the best preparation care of people, and indeed professional actors elsewhere, were making the connection. Northwestern's university, blah, blah, blah. Some relatives worried that they couldn't make Garner's method work because they weren't good actors. They found the constant manipulation upsetting. It's not manipulation, Jesus. It's not manipulation. Why are you you're manipulating them you're manipulating them into believing your reality. You're manipulating them into, being in alignment with your own version of reality. That's manipulation. That's coercion. And feared that their deceptions would be detected. Garner recognised that sticking to her method with the necessary consistency required a certain emotional remove. Okay, I understand that. It's a bit different. It's easier for me to do it maybe as a care worker than it would be. But then I did it with my nan as well. I did it with my nan. She thought she owned a care home, but she thought it was an airport and that all the planes were flying to America. We just went along with it. We'd go, don't be too hard on the staff, don't nan. Don't be too hard because, you know, firm but fair. Firm but fair is the managerial approach you need to execute here, I believe. Also, you are having sex with quite a lot of your staff, you libidinous old goat. So probably want to nip that in the bud. You will be up front in front of a tribunal if you that, but that conduct carries on. And also, it's killing us. It's killing your family. Every day we come with a new story about you flinging your bags of flour about. It's killing us. Look at Dad. His face is ashen. So she concluded, in order to put a method properly into effect, it was necessary for the relative to stop thinking of the person with dementia as their mother or father or husband or wife. They must start thinking of them instead as their client. Don't like the word client. Wouldn't have used it. Also, I don't know. I don't think you can do that. It's very difficult. I think you should still think of them as like, just understand that they recognize your face. You're a comfort to them. They know you. They know there's a foundation of trust there, but they can't always place you. They can't always place exactly what role you play in their life. And so rather than, you know, being selfish and petty and you're thinking like, I'm the son. That's the role. I'm the son. How can you forget your son? Think, I am now entering my mum's childhood. She recognizes me. She knows I'm someone she can be safe with, but maybe I'm no longer her son in this scenario. It's fucking hard. Hard. Really, really hard. And heartbreaking. But what do you want to do? Do you want to do what's best for them or for you? Other relatives worried that to lie was to betray a trust. To them, Garner said, grow up. I agree. To insist on the truth seemed her immature and selfish. Yes. When a vulnerable person's happiness was at stake. Yes. Having witnessed the desperate anxiety that could make life with dementia a hell for both the sufferer and the family, she felt that to worry that lying was bad was to miss the whole point. Some dementia experts felt that Garner's approach was unethical because it encouraged delusions. The British Alzheimer's Society, fuck you, felt strongly enough about this that it issued a formal statement on the subject. We struggle to see how systematically deceiving someone with dementia can be part of an authentic, trusting relationship and when the person's voice is heard and their rights promoted. Okay, so you promote their rights to self-determination. So they have determined that they are young, that they're 13 years old now, that their husband is alive, that this is what they're telling you, and this is what they the concept of self-determination is pointing to. This is what they are saying to you and what they have decided. The person with dementia has decided this. So how the fuck is going against that? Is how is that promoting the right to self-determination and listening to them, listening to what they're telling you? Fucking idiots. But to Garner, the reality of people with dementia was not a delusion in the way that a belief that they were Queen Victoria and Napoleon would be. It was not a delusion, but a memory. Yes. This is perfect. Exactly that. I once had a woman who thought she was a licorice plant. I dispelled that delusion, I told her she wasn't, because that's not a memory. Her clients were living in reality. They were just using the reality of the past to understand the present. Besides, she wasn't promoting delusions. She was just refusing to correct them. You're not actively reinforcing the idea that Fred is alive when you know he's died, she said. You're simply not disturbing the idea that Fred is alive, that the person with dementia already has. Imagine a conversation between two people in which one says, Fred is so good at tennis, and the other says, yes, Fred is good at tennis, but we can't forget that he's dead. It's so fucking weird. Like, that the Alzheimer's Society would... This is crazy. Fucking Alzheimer's Society. Pricks. Oh, a bunch of pricks. Cannot stand them, but they also do very good work, I'm sure. It's a hefty area of inquiry, selfhood, anyway. So difficult to untangle. Even when it's directed at myself, like, what do I find important? What are my values? How do I balance my robust individualism with the necessary encumbrances of society? Mainly using my individualism to earn social acceptance. And going on stage to talk about breastfeeding porn during a charity benefit isn't the best way to do that. But since the concept of personhood and selfhood is a subject with such metaphysical profundity on these podcasts, I try not to drill that deeply into the pre-existing corpus of Western philosophy, as I'm already breathless, as you can tell, under the weight of this topic. But I'll kick it around a little bit, punt it against the wall. Right, like one of those kids who attempts, is it Cruyff turns, despite never owning a football. Is it Cruyff? But yeah, care ethics, man. That's my thing. And an organizing principle that runs counter to self-interest. So back to this book about education, higher education. What is particularly troubling in US society is the absence of the vital formative cultures necessary to construct. I mean, imagine that, just like going around the care home and going, remember your husband? Yeah, he's in the swimming pool. No, he's not. He's dead. You, Mara, remember your husband? Yeah, he was in the Hitler Youth. Yeah, no, not anymore. He's dead. What about yours? He's dying. He's dying. He's still here. He's hanging on, but he's got about 4 days left. 4 days left. Yeah, 4 days left. Oh, just that's what the Alzheimer's Society wants you to do. And what sets this generation of young people apart from past generations is that today's youth have been immersed since birth in a relentless, spreading, neoliberal pedagogical apparatus with its celebration of an unbridled individualism and its near pathological disdain for community. Yes. Oh, I'm so G'd up now. Public values and public good. So that's what I believe in. Community, public values, public good. They have been inundated by a market-driven value system that encourages a culture of competitiveness and produces a theatre of cruelty that has resulted in what Bauman calls a weakening of democratic pressures, a growing inability to act politically, and a massive exit from politics and from responsible citizenship. Yet they refuse to allow this deadening apparatus of false manufactured ignorance and ideological domination to shape their lives. No, I will not let it shape my life. I believe in community. I believe in public good. I believe in having all hands together. I've gone deaf in my ear. Shite. I believe we all have a duty to help one another. Reclaiming both the possibilities inherent in the political use of digital technologies and social media, US students are now protesting in increasing numbers the ongoing intense attacks on higher education and the welfare state, refusing a social order shaped by what, as Axel Honneth describes, as an abyss of failed sociality. Yes, one in which the perceived suffering of youth has still not found resonance in the public space of articulation. I want to be the person, oh, that's self-interest, isn't it? I want to be one of many people who bring back community, bring back mutual aid, rebuild the welfare state, hand the reins back over to localities, to, you know, local government. It's a groupuscule approach. And we'd stop marginalising the old and the infirm, the mentally ill. Stop marginalisation, full stop. Stop the marketisation and profiteering of social enterprise. Yeah, it's pretty much all my shit. Pretty much all, as long as I can skim a little cream off the top. Yeah, as long as I can scream a little bit. Not monetarily, though. I'm not looking for money. I'm not looking for money at all. I've been putting on gigs lately where I don't take the money. I don't want that. I just want to put on cool stuff. I want to put on cool stuff and panel discussions and listen to interesting people talk about interesting things. It's what it is. It's about, I suppose, creative control is important, but like also building relationships and having a social conscience in the stuff you do. Yeah. That's why I do eventually, like when I get to a point I've built my public profile, I do want to go into kind of pivot into activism, definitely. I mean, I've already been doing it with the elders and stuff. But that's why I think you have to be wary sometimes. People throw money out, some say. I was positioning myself in opposition to them as you know, just a bit of comedy fodder. But I do think there's real problems with the rhetoric they're espousing. And so don't just chuck money indiscriminately. Be quite discerning with who you're giving it to, because I don't know. I don't want to fund something where they're leading dementia care in the completely wrong direction. Completely wrong direction. And so it's like, I'll just get on to... sorry, I'm just getting... Oh, I've gone deaf in that ear, you know? So, yeah, there should never be a one-size-fits-all homogenizing prescribed way of talking to people with dementia as if they're just like a one unit. Because it's person-centered care. Tom Kitwood, he was at the forefront of this person-centered care approach, and Dr. Shibley Rahman has sort of continued his legacy. The same thing. An upper management will promote an essentialist view of dementia, and Alzheimer's Society as well does. By issuing notices on how to communicate with residents, implying they're a single homogenous unit, whereas the most sought-after carers like me were the ones who residents and family members are pleased to see and shift. The ones people confide in or air their grievances to are those who are adaptive and recognise the dynamic interplay that takes place within an interpersonal and social context. So it's keep that in mind. All right. Well, yeah, no, we got a bit feisty today, but I hope you enjoyed this episode. And yeah, love to you all. Love to the kids. Love to the kids. Love to the family. And yeah, see you next week.